So it's the last talk of the day. I'll try not to go over time. Thanks to the organizers for the invitation to speak here. I'm going to return to a topic that was, again, related to the theme of the workshop, decoherence, a topic that was touched on in Frank Wilhelm's talk. And that is the idea of measurement-induced dephasing, or decoherence coming from the actual detection process. And so the title of this talk is Quantum-Limited Back Action in Strongly Correlated Detectors. And the question that we've been interested in trying to understand or get a handle on is, if we have some kind of mesoscopic electron qubit readout or quantum amplifier, can it have a Heisenberg-limited back action if it has strong interactions? There are strong interactions between the electrons in this detector. Okay, and this might seem like an artificial kind of question. What are the actual systems I have in mind that I want to get to? Well, one is a quantum point contact detector, but now quantum point contact found in a strongly interacting 1D system, so in a Luttinger liquid. Again, that still might not sound like a terribly realistic system to look at. Well, it turns out that system, the interacting quantum point contact, is very closely related to a much more, you know, useful, realistic system that we've already heard about, and that is the DC squid amplifier. Okay, and so that's where I want to sort of get to, at least by the end of the talk. Just to make things intelligible, I'm actually going to start by reviewing some older work that really puts this question here in context. And so for those of you who have already heard this before, you know, bear with me until I get to the new stuff. Okay, so the general theme, again, is the idea of the back action of a measurement. You know from our first class in quantum mechanics that any time we try to make a measurement quantum mechanically, we must necessarily induce a disturbance in the quantity conjugate to what we're measuring. Again, the classic example, the Heisenberg microscope, we try to make a measurement of position, we must, you know, induce a disturbance in the momentum. Okay, so what's the general interesting question that, and I've been interested in for, I guess, a couple of years now. The general interesting question is, we know there are these constraints on the back action. We know there needs to be a back action. But what in general ensures we get the minimal possible back action? Is there some general way of thinking about this question? Some general set of symmetries or principles that ensure a particular detector will have the smallest possible back action consistent with Heisenberg? Okay, and in even more particular, can we actually achieve such an ideal back action in a complicated solid-state detector? Okay, you know, at first glance, you might think such systems are so complicated, so many degrees of freedom, it's going to be very difficult to come to this ideal Heisenberg limit. Okay, so that's the general kind of question. Just to make things a bit more specific, how does this question of an ideal back action actually manifest itself in real experiments in this field? Again, the easiest class of experiments to look at would be some experiment where you're trying to read out the state of a qubit. Okay, so here's an example coming from Charlie Marcus's group. The qubit here is a double dot qubit formed in a semiconducting two-dimensional electron gas. So that's what you're looking at here. Here's the left dot, the right dot. Let's imagine this is a charged qubit, so the two states of my qubit are the electron could be on the left, the electron could be on the right. What's the readout in this system? The readout is this quantum point contact I've already mentioned. It's this narrow constriction in the 2-deg next to this right quantum dot. This constriction here is actually a conductor. You can pass current through this thing, weed out its conductance. And the idea of how this thing works as a detector is, well, if the electron in my double dot qubit is sitting in the right dot, it's going to change the potential in this quantum point contact. It's going to change the conductance. So by measuring the conductance of the point contact, you get a measure of the state of your qubit. Okay, that's the measurement side. What's the back action here? Well, if I initially started my qubit out in a superposition of electron on the left, electron on the right, the measurement has to dephase that superposition. In this system, the measurement is essentially a measurement of, is the electron on the right? It's going to dephase a state like that. So we know that's going to happen. What's the interesting question? The interesting question is, how quickly does that dephasing occur? Okay? Heisenberg essentially put a limit to how slowly that dephasing can occur. And now the question is, can we actually realize that in this system or in other such systems with other choices for what the detector is here? Okay, and how do we get a handle on those kinds of questions? Why is this interesting? We know dephasing is going to occur. Who cares how quickly it occurs? Well, there are a number of things you could only do with a detector that had an ideal back action. That is, a detector that really gave you this dephasing time from the measurement, tau phi, being as long as possible. So So applications such as quantum control, for example, really require a detector that's close to this Heisenberg limit. So there really is practical sort of motivation for understanding how do we get there. Okay, and so... Okay, so there are a number of different systems where this question is relevant. Again, a qubit and some kind of readout. Even with these solid-state qubits, there are all sorts of things you could use as your readout device, a quantum point contact, a single electron transistor, a superconducting single electron transistor. Which of these things is better? Which comes closer to the Heisenberg limit? This question is also directly relevant to the, I guess, the topic of the last talk, to this area of quantum nanomechanics. There's a great deal of interest in learning or trying to do quantum limited position detection. Again, this really boils down to the same question. If you want to do continuous position detection at the quantum limit, you need to have a detector that has this kind of ideal back action. Okay, so how do we get there? So the general approach that, you know, I've been using for these questions is to make use of two things in these experiments that really simplify matters. And typically in these experiments, you're in a regime where the coupling between the detector and the object being detected, whether it's a qubit or an oscillator, that coupling is weak. And you're also in a regime where your detector operates linearly. Okay, and so that regime, you can have a very generic description of all these kinds of systems. Okay, and so here's this kind of generic description of what I call a mesoscopic detection experiment. We have some object that we're trying to detect the state of. We have some detector that's coupled to our object. Okay, and so let's take that input system to just be the state of a qubit. We're trying to measure the sigma z value of the qubit. Our detector, in principle, is something complicated. It could be far from equilibrium. It could have strong correlations, as I've already, you know, alluded to. All we need to know about it within this kind of linear response approach is, hey, the detector has some input port, some output port. Both of those ports have operators associated with them. Okay, so on the input side, there's some force operator, this operator F. This is the thing that will actually couple to our qubit in the Hamiltonian. So again, I'm interested in systems where there's a weak coupling. I'm interested in coupling Hamiltonians of this form here. So this input operator F, the thing I'm trying to measure, and some coupling strength A. Okay, so that's the input side of my detector. The output side of my detector, there's some operator I associated with this port. That's the thing we actually read off the detector. So if I'm talking about a quantum point contact, I'm actually measuring some current to figure out the state of my qubit. That the output operator I is just the current. Okay, and again, I'm interested in the systems where I have a weak coupling, where the detector responds linearly. I expect that if I look at the average value of my output, the average value of this operator I, there's a piece that just is proportional to what my input system is doing. Okay, so this weak coupling linear response set of assumptions might sound really strong, but again, there are a lot of experiments that really do fall into this regime. This is an interesting regime to look at. And in particular, the four experiments I had in the previous slide are all within this regime. Okay? So what is it we want to understand about our detector? So again, the idea is this coupling is going to be really weak between the detector and the qubit. I can just focus on the properties of the detector. Well, to understand how good a detector really is, I need to get a handle on its noise properties. There's going to be noise at the output, noise at the input. There could be some cross-correlation in those noises. Okay, how are those noises characterized? I have spectral densities for the noise at the input, the noise at the output, the cross-correlator. How are those defined quantum mechanically? Well, again, as Franck has already motivated for us, these noise spectral densities are essentially given by this symmetrized noise correlator. Okay, and so the thing we want to focus on, the thing that's going to really affect the quality of the measurement, are these noise spectral densities. Okay, and so now the question is, what can I say about these noise spectral densities? And again, the problem is, I don't want to really say too much about what my detector is, what its Hamiltonian is, what its density matrix is, whether it's in equilibrium or not. Okay, and so given that, can I really say anything about these noise spectral densities? Yeah?
What exactly is the delta
So at this stage, I'm focusing on the detector in isolation. I want to understand its noise in the absence of the coupling to the qubit. And this delta I, as I've just subtracted off, the mean value of I in the absence of any coupling to the qubit.
Okay, so you said I is zero.
That's right, that's right. And the idea is knowing the noise at weak coupling is still relevant when I'm coupled to the qubit because, again, I'm interested in weak couplings.
Okay.
Okay, so we want to understand something about these noise correlators. What can we say about them given the fact that we don't want to specify much about the detector? Well, it turns out that we can actually say a fair bit. There's a powerful constraint on those noise correlators. So again, classically, you couldn't really say anything about those noise correlators. All you could really say was, hey, the cross-correlation can't be any bigger than the product of the output noise and the input noise. Quantum mechanically, you can say something much stronger. Quantum mechanically, essentially, if you have some gain, if you have a detector, some response, this product of noises, the output noise times the input noise minus the correlated part, that has to be non-zero. So if our detector really works as a detector, if there's some linear response, the noise cannot be vanishingly small. Okay, and there's a very, very general constraint on quantum noise. Where does it come from? Well, not surprisingly, it comes from the same place as the ordinary Heisenberg uncertainty relations. The usual Heisenberg uncertainty relations, we have two operators that don't commute. Their dispersions can't be arbitrarily small in a given state. Well, essentially, it's the same thing that's going on here. So here, to really have response, to have our detector respond to what's going on at the input, we need this response coefficient lambda to be non-zero. So what is this just within perturbation theory? This is given by a Kubo formula. It's given by the commutator of the output operator, the input operator at different times. So to have response, these two operators can't commute for all time. It's that lack of commutivity that leads directly to this noise constraint here. Okay? And so what's nice about this is, okay, you know, even though we haven't specified anything about our detector, even though we haven't really specified very much about the state of the detector, we have this very general constraint on its noise. We now have a sense in which we can even define a detector with ideal quantum noise. What does it mean to have ideal quantum noise? Well, it means that this inequality becomes an equality. Our detector has, again, this left-hand side as small as possible. And so why is that something that's relevant? Well, again, we're interested in detectors that actually reach the quantum limit, detectors that have an ideal back action. Well, in this weak coupling regime, that's completely the same as having a detector which has ideal quantum noise, a detector that reaches an equality here. Okay, so I could ask about a specific measurement task. Again, this question of, imagine I'm measuring the state of the qubit. I know there's measurement-induced dephasing. There's a constraint on how small can that measurement-induced dephasing rate be. It essentially can't be any smaller than the rate at which we get information from the measurement. How do I actually get an equality there? Well, again, just a couple of lines of algebra. Getting an equality there is the same thing as reaching an equality here. Okay? A more general kind of task is, imagine it's not the state of a qubit I want to measure. Imagine it's some time-dependent signal at the input. So again, it's a position detector, let's say. In this case, what I'm really talking about is a quantum linear amplifier. In this case, the way I can think about the back action is in terms of a noise temperature. My amplifier is going to add some noise to my input signal. There'll be more noise at the output than there was at the input. The temperature associated with that noise can't be arbitrarily small. Okay, it has to be bigger than h bar omega over 2. So this quantum limit too, the amplifier quantum limit, which is relevant to these experiments on quantum nanomechanics, that also, again with a bit of work, you can show boils down to achieving an equality in this quantum noise constraint. Okay, so to understand how we get an ideal quantum detector, we need to understand how do we get ideal quantum noise. Yeah? That's right. So I'm focusing on the case of, you can phrase it as, I'm assuming one thing about the state of my detector. It has a time-independent density matrix. So that's equivalent to basically saying that I have no phase sensitivity in my system. So I'm interested in the amplifier case, amplifiers that are phase-preserving, which in a lot of cases are definitely of interest. Yeah. Okay, so ideal quantum detector, we need to get ideal quantum noise. Again, the next thing is to really understand what does it mean to get ideal quantum noise. For a given system, what does it take to get an equality there? Okay, and so one way formally to understand where this inequality comes from, you can really look at it as a Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. To optimize a Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, you need a proportionality condition. Again, that all seems very formal, but just using those ideas, you can actually prove that there's no way you can saturate this inequality if you're in thermal equilibrium. Okay, so one thing that just pops out immediately from this kind of formulation is there's no way you can have ideal noise if your detector is in equilibrium. Okay, but we still want a better way of thinking about what does it mean to have ideal quantum noise. Okay, and so the thing that we did, again, was to basically take these ideas and implement them in a real system, a system that's rich enough that it can both reach or fail to reach the quantum limit. So the thing that we looked at was essentially a generalization of this quantum point contact detector. So we talk about it as a mesoscopic scattering detector. We have some phase coherent scattering region for electrons attached by a point contacts or electron waveguides to reservoirs on the left and the right. And now the idea is that this thing is going to be our detector for the state of a qubit. Okay, so the idea is, well, first of all, how do I describe transport through such a thing? Well, this system here is described by some scattering matrix. Let's just go back a slide. And so let's take the simplest possible case where I have a single channel in both the input and that output point contact. I have some 2x2 scattering matrix, a transmission coefficient, a reflection coefficient. To get the current, what do? Well, we have this nice Landauer formula. I essentially integrate the transmission probability, the transmission coefficient, between, you know, over this energy window that's set by the voltage. Okay, so that's the current through this point contact, this generalized point contact. How does it work as a detector? Well, again, the idea is the qubit is somehow electrostatically coupled to this scattering region. Changing the state of the qubit changes the potential in the scattering region, changes the transmission coefficient, changes the current. Okay, and again, just the simplest case to consider is the case where when I change the state of the qubit, the potential change that's brought about in that scattering region is completely smooth. Okay, I mean, the extreme WKB limit, in that case, yeah, changing the state of the qubit changes the potential in the scattering region, but that's the same thing, it's just changing the energy at which I look at the scattering matrix. So life becomes simple there. So in that case, again, two states of the qubit, I have two different scattering matrices, but now the difference between those two different scattering matrices, is the qubit up or is it down, is just proportional to the energy derivative of the scattering matrix. Okay, same thing, the difference between the two different transmission probabilities is just proportional to the energy derivative of that transmission coefficient. Okay, so this is a sufficiently simple system that we can actually do a lot with it. It's also something that's not completely removed from what's actually used in experiments like this. So I can now ask, in this system, in this generalized quantum point contact, what do you actually have to do to get this ideal noise, to get, you know, to actually reach the quantum limit? And so in this system, just one last thing, the output operator I was talking about is still just the current through this point contact. The input operator, the thing that actually couples to the qubit, that's just the total charge in this scattering region. Okay, so what I want to really understand is what's the noise in this output current, what's the charge fluctuation in that scattering region. Okay, and that's something you can, you know, go ahead and calculate. You can basically calculate these quantities in terms of the scattering states of this system. You can insist that I want to have ideal quantum noise. And what that translates to in this system is constraints on the scattering matrix. So insisting that this system has an equality and that noise inequality basically gives me these two conditions on the scattering matrix. Okay, there's one condition on the phases appearing in the scattering matrix. There's one condition appearing on the transmission coefficient itself. Okay, and just to make a kind of long story short, how do we understand what these conditions are actually telling us? Again, you might think that it related to some kind of simple symmetry, like having time reversal symmetry or inversion symmetry. It turns out none of those symmetries are really, you know, the thing that you need to guarantee these conditions hold. A simple way of understanding these conditions is to actually think about things in terms of wasted information. So if I'm trying to detect the state of my qubit by measuring the current, there better not be any other quantity I could be looking at which would also tell me about the state of my qubit. If there is, there's wasted information in the system, I'm not going to reach the quantum limit. I'm not going to have ideal quantum noise. So how does that work? Well, this condition here, and again, just comes very formally from insisting on, hey, that noise inequality is optimized. This condition here, beta is a phase associated with the reflection of an electron, phi with the transmission of an electron. This inequality, or this condition here, is saying, essentially, the qubit, if I change the state of the qubit, it cannot change the relative phase between transmission and reflection. And so what does that mean? If you tried to be smart and learn something about your qubit, not just by measuring the current, but by doing an interference experiment. Interfere the reflected and transmitted beam. This condition tells you, hey, you won't learn anything new. The interference term in that experiment would involve this phase difference. That phase difference is not modulated by changing the state of the qubit. Okay? So there's a very direct way of understanding what does it take to reach, to get ideal quantum noise, and thinking about wasted information. And again, I'm not going to go into it. This concept of wasted information can sound a little loose. You can definitely make this rigorous using ideas from information theory. Okay, there's another condition here which is going to turn out to be very important when we go to the case of the interacting quantum point contact. But the condition here that basically says the energy derivative of my transmission coefficient, my transmission probability, has to be proportional to T times 1 minus D. C here is just some real constant. Okay, so how do I understand that in terms of this idea of wasted information? Well, this condition is basically saying that we don't lose any information when we average over energy. Okay, so when I actually measure the current in this kind of setup, that involves basically doing an energy average of scattering states in this entire energy window defined by the voltage. The voltage in this system comes in as a difference in the chemical potentials between the left and the right reservoirs. To get the current, I'm involving contributions from all of these states. And one can go ahead and calculate the measurement rate. For this kind of setup, how quickly do you get information about the state of the qubit? You could imagine a more complicated experiment where you actually could resolve how much current is coming from each slice of energy. Okay, so you don't actually, you know, measure the current at just one single voltage. You actually have knowledge of the full IV, let's say. And in general, there's more information associated with this measurement. If you don't do this average over energy first, in general, this measurement rate is much bigger than it is for this experiment. Okay? So when do you learn nothing new in the second more complicated experiment? Again, just a little bit of algebra shows you that it's exactly when this condition holds. Okay, so again, the point here is we wanted our system to have ideal quantum noise so it reaches the quantum limit. What do we need to do to sort of have that happen? Well, there can't be any wasted information in this system. And this condition on the transmission amplitudes can be interpreted in that way. We don't want to be losing information when we average over energy. Okay? Okay, so that's the situation for this non-interacting, phase-coherent quantum point contact. Again, this nice sort of, you know, line of reasoning to reach the quantum limit, ideal quantum noise, no wasted information. A natural question to now ask is, well, what happens if we make the system more complicated? Okay, and you can imagine adding more channels to the system. You can imagine making it superconducting. All this general reasoning, you know, still works. A way of making things much more complicated, though, is let's not just add interactions to our system. Let's add strong interactions to my system. Okay, so imagine I still have this quantum point contact. I've got my qubit. It's modulating some transmission probability. But now imagine my quantum point contact is sitting in a strongly interacting 1D electron liquid. So imagine my quantum point contact is in a Luttinger liquid. Okay, and I guess this is something that could really be realized. You could imagine using an edge state in some kind of fractional quantum Hall system. That could be your quantum interacting quantum point contact detector. So now the question is, if we're in this kind of strongly interacting regime, do we still have a quantum limited back action? Okay, so if I turn on the interactions, and even though I've sort of satisfied these conditions here, do I still stay at the quantum limit? And one way to think about it is you could think of everything in terms of this idea of no wasted information. When you turn on the interactions, are there new avenues by which you could actually be losing information? Okay, and so how do we address that kind of question?
I'm sorry,
The electrons are interacting with themselves. The description that I gave you here in terms of this Landauer sort of formula using a transmission coefficient, a scattering matrix, that's really for non-interacting electrons. Okay, so now I want to go to the opposite regime where the electrons aren't just the interactions between electrons aren't just having a small effect compared to a non-interacting picture. They're really changing, again, the underlying electron system completely. Okay, what are these sort of, you know, these ideas of having ideal noise look like in that kind of system? Okay, and so a way of thinking about this system is I've got this point contact. I can think of that point contact if I'm in the weak tunneling regime, as I have some tunnel Hamiltonian that takes electrons from the left to the right and vice versa, my qubit modulates the state, modulates the size of that tunnel matrix element. Okay? So again, this system might seem, okay, maybe from a theoretical point of view, kind of interesting, but why would anyone use something like that as a real detector? Okay, and the reason that this is interesting to study from a practical point of view is that this interacting quantum point contact, the quantum point contact in a Luttinger liquid, really is very intimately related to the DC squid amplifier, okay, to the you know, detector that Jan Kissia was telling us about. Okay, and just to kind of, in a simplified way, motivate how the DC squid amplifier is connected to this interacting point contact, here's a kind of, you know, a very simplified version of a way you can think about a DC squid amplifier. Okay, so now I have a Josephson junction, a tunneling Cooper pairs, I have this Josephson Hamiltonian. The idea is my input signal is going to modulate the Josephson energy. It's going to modulate, in a sense, the amount of tunneling through this junction here. Okay, and I put this thing in a circuit, I've got some voltage bias, I've got some impedance in the circuit. How is this thing like the quantum point contact detector? Well, I modulate my input signal, this flux, it modulates the size of the Josephson energy, it's going to modulate the size of the current in this circuit. Okay, that's very much like a quantum point contact detector. Quantum point contact, my input signal, my qubit, modulates the transmission coefficient, modulates the current. Okay, and so there is an analogy there. Why would I say in this system that we have strong correlations? Well, it's the presence of this environmental impedance, which you can really think of as a bath, of a bosonic bath. It's the presence of that impedance that really gives me the strong correlations. Okay, if I'm going towards the quantum limit, working at zero temperature, this environmental impedance is going to induce long-range in time correlations between tunnel events. Okay, and that's a strong correlation aspect here. Okay? So again, let's see if I can get this all in. Okay, so in reality, the squid doesn't look like what I just showed you there. In reality, the squid looks like what Jan showed us. It's a bit more complicated. We have this loop. We have two different Josephson junctions, two different shunt impedances, and we have some current bias to this system. Okay, the thing that's measured out isn't a current. The thing that's measured is a voltage. So the squid, in reality, is a flux to voltage amplifier. I have some input signal. It's a flux. It essentially modulates how much current is going through those Josephson junctions. Okay? I can relate this output voltage directly to what's the current going through those Josephson junctions. Essentially, to know the voltage, I need to know how much current is going through the impedances. I know what that is if I know what the current is going through the Josephson junctions. Okay? And so the question is, can the DC squid have quantum ideal noise? Can it reach the quantum limit? Can it actually have a quantum limited noise temperature? Okay, so that's the question, another way of looking at the question that we want to answer. And again, this isn't a new question to pose. This is something that, you know, has a long history, part of, you know, Roger's definitely part of that. And the thing that's different in our approach is, I guess the main way this question has been looked at in the past is to actually use the quantum Langevin equation. To use the quantum Langevin equation the way that condensed matter physicists use it, which is essentially to write down a classical-looking Langevin equation, not an operator equation, and then basically say that your force noise, its correlation function, is given by the quantum fluctuation dissipation theorem. So it's a nice equation to use. It's easy to put onto a computer. The problem with that is it's not really valid in the quantum regime of interest. As soon as I have a nonlinear system, in a sense, that's an uncontrolled approximation. So we want to go back and understand, can the DC squid reach the quantum limit using a more controlled approach, okay, one that doesn't rely on the quantum Langevin equation. And the idea is that because this is so simple or similar to that Luttinger liquid system, to a system with an impurity in the Luttinger liquid, we can really use a lot of the technical machinery that's been developed to deal with that interacting electron system to look at this system here. Okay, and so again, I'm not going to go through all the details because I have about 5-10 minutes. But the first thing we can do is make that more complicated-looking DC squid again look like this more friendly-looking circuit here, something that looks closer to a quantum point contact. Okay, and this is something you can do on a path integral level, describing this thing with the Keldysh functional integral. But the nice news is that I can make my real BC squid look like a single junction system, look like a quantum point contact system. The only price I pay is, hey, I started with two junctions, two phases. Even in this system, I need to have 2 degrees of freedom. So really, what does a DC squid look like? It looks like a quantum point contact or a single junction system where, yes, the input signal, the flux, modulates the size of that Josephson coupling, but that Josephson coupling has its own intrinsic fluctuations. So I had two phases to start with. I still have two phases. One of those phases shows up as a kind of unwanted fluctuation. Okay? It's as if I had a point contact where, forget about doing any measurement, that the tunnel coupling, the transmission coefficient, was just fluctuating on its own. So one thing you need to do to reach the quantum limit is definitely you don't want these unwanted fluctuations, this extra fluctuation, that they're on top of what you would have in a quantum point contact. Okay, and so you can easily relate what are the fluctuations of that Josephson coupling to impedances in the problem. And essentially, it's this variable theta whose fluctuations we don't want. That variable's fluctuations are determined by an impedance which involves the resistance of the junction, the shunt resistance, the capacitance, but also the loop impedance, or the loop inductance of the system. And so to really suppress these unwanted fluctuations, you really want to go to a limit where that loop impedance is going to zero. Okay, so that's one thing already you need to do. In that limit, and again, you can get some expressions here, in that limit, you really have a complete analogy to a quantum point contact. In that limit, if you can treat the tunneling perturbatively, then you definitely reach the quantum limit. Okay, so that's the first lesson we learned from this approach, that really on a formal level, any time you have your loop impedance, or your loop impedance being non-zero, that's going to involve a deviation from the quantum limit. Okay? So the second thing is, okay, well, this is just, imagine I do take this loop impedance going to zero. I don't have to worry about that fluctuation in the Josephson energy, that fluctuation coming from this variable theta. I then have a system that looks exactly like the interacting quantum point contact. I can still ask, does it reach the quantum limit? So I get rid of this extra degree of freedom. Can I still get ideal quantum noise? Okay? And what happens in that case? Well, first of all, just in perturbation theory, you find that in perturbation theory, to lowest order in the tunneling, you always reach the quantum limit. Okay, and so for the interacting quantum point contact case, that says as long as you're in a tunneling regime, it doesn't matter how strong the interactions are, you're at the quantum limit. That's kind of interesting. Changing the size of the interactions, you can really go from, again, a picture where you have electrons tunneling to fractionally charged quasiparticles tunneling. This perturbative result basically tells you, hey, as long as the thing is tunneling, it doesn't matter if it's electrons or quasiparticles or whatever, you're going to be at the quantum limit. Okay, the more interesting and kind of complicated question is, well, what happens if you're in a limit where you can't just do first-order perturbation theory? Okay, for a squid, that corresponds to, imagine I don't have my bias current much, much, much bigger than the critical current. Imagine the bias current is comparable to the critical current, or not that much bigger than the critical current. Okay, in that case, what you have to worry about is you don't just have processes where a single Cooper pair tunnels. You now have higher-order processes in perturbation theory. You now have processes where 2 Cooper pairs tunnel, 3 Cooper pairs tunnel, 4 Cooper pairs tunnel. You have to worry about all these things. And this suggests a way of missing the quantum limit. So in the discussion of the non-interacting point contact, I basically said that, hey, doing this energy average can lead to a departure from the quantum limit. Okay? There's wasted information that you're losing when you average over the current coming from all these different energy scattering states. Well, here too, you would think that, well, maybe if I'm in a regime where all these different processes are contributing, and I'm averaging them when I measure the total voltage across my squid, the total Cooper pair current, maybe that's a way of actually losing information. There's information in actually knowing how much current came from this process versus that process. Okay, so the question is, do you still reach the quantum limit when you have these multiple processes? Okay, and again, I'm not going to go through all the details. A nice way of addressing this question is to make it another kind of analogy. And that is to realize that not only the DC squid, like an interacting quantum point contact, it's also like a dissipative type binding model. So all of this physics you can really map onto rigorously onto the simple type binding model, where I have a particle on this 1D lattice, I have some tunnel matrix element delta, and I have some bias. So my particle, as it goes down this lattice, the energies go down. And the bias corresponds to the voltage in this picture here. This tunnel matrix element corresponds to the Josephson energy. And again, I have a coupling to a bath. So I have this particle moving on this 1D lattice. Again, fields is fluctuating forth from some bosonic ohmic bath. And that corresponds to the influence of this shunt impedance here. Okay, so now to understand the fluctuations, the noise in my DC squid, in this interacting quantum point contact, I can actually look at quantities in this dissipative type binding model. Okay, and just to make, again, a long story short, how does this analogy work? If I want to understand the current noise in this system, the output noise of my amplifier, that actually corresponds to sort of displacement statistics in this dissipative type binding model. If I start with my particle at this lattice site here, let's call it zero, and wait some time t, where will it be after a time t? Okay, and so basically, the variance in that quantity maps on directly to the output noise of my DC squid, the voltage noise, if you want. Okay, the other quantity we have to worry about is, let's do that here. We also want to know what the back action, right? That's the other thing that's important in understanding, do we reach the quantum limit? Okay, the back action, again, I have some coupling Hamiltonian of this form. My input signal is just coupling or changing the size of the Josephson energy. The back action force that couples to my input signal is just the cosine of the phase of my junction. Okay, that corresponds to the circulating current in my DC squid. Okay, so now the question is, what does that look like in this dissipative type binding model? Okay, and a way to think about that is, again, I'm going to be interested in displacement statistics for this model here, but now I'm going to think about things in terms of a density matrix. Okay, so now I can think about, imagine I start with my particle at, you know, definitely at some point zero and no coherence. So I can think of that as starting in some density matrix element zero, zero. And then I can think about processes that take me to some other diagonal state, so some other final state on this lattice. And I can think about processes, two different kinds of processes that would take me there. One that takes me there as efficiently as possible. And so again, this grid here corresponds to both the diagonal elements of my density matrix, off-diagonal elements. So this is one kind of process in perturbation theory that could take me from here to here. There's another kind of process in perturbation theory that could take me from here to here that's a lot less efficient. It involves, in a sense, too many excursions to off-diagonal density matrix elements. So in general, I can associate rates for these kinds of processes, a rate that basically tells me both what's the net displacement in terms of the final diagonal state, the initial diagonal state, but then also another parameter, so that diagonal part, the classical displacement I'll call M, there's another part, Z, which tells me, hey, what's the net number of vertical versus horizontal moves? So for this completely efficient process, that would be zero. There's an equal number of horizontal and vertical moves. For this kind of process here, there's an excess number of vertical moves. And so that would correspond to this quantity Z being non-zero. So it turns out you can very simply relate the back action noise to this kind of quantum displacement. Okay? So if I have a process like this, the thing that matters for the back action noise isn't where do I end up in the density matrix, it's again this quantity Z. The fluctuations in that will determine this. Okay, and again, this correspondence between what's going on in this model here and this Josephson junction system, that's something that just comes out by looking at the perturbative expansions for both these systems. Okay, and so what's the nice thing that actually occurs? So again, the current is related to this kind of classical displacement, the back action noise to this this kind of quantum displacement. What you actually find is there's a kind of complete duality between these two quantities. That essentially, a rate that has no classical displacement, but does have this kind of quantum charge, excess vertical versus horizontal moves, is exactly equal to a rate that has no excess horizontal versus vertical moves, but takes me directly from one density matrix state to a final density matrix state. So there's this kind of duality between transport in this classical and quantum direction, and it's that duality which exactly lets you reach the quantum limit. Okay, and so, again, for details, there's a recent paper that you can look at. So again, it's kind of asking this seemingly, you know, very practical question, can we have a quantum limited noise temperature for a DC squid? We end up finding these kind of, you know, in my mind at least, sort of deep connections, deep dualities in this dissipative type binding model. Okay, and so just the one last thing, where do these kind of dualities actually come from? What's a more systematic way of understanding them than seeing that, hey, in perturbation theory, these cancellations always occur? Well, another way of looking at this system is actually to look at it in terms of the underlying field theory. And it turns out there's an integrable quantum field theory that describes this system. Within that integrable quantum field theory, you can actually have a scattering matrix for now, you know, soliton and anti-soliton excitations. What these excitations are in terms of physical particles or electrons, that's something that's, you know, incredibly complicated to sort of map out. But the amazing thing is, if you look at that scattering matrix for a soliton going to an anti-soliton, and look at what's its derivative with respect to the strength of the Josephson energy, the strength of the backscattering, it satisfies the same equation that we said had to be satisfied for a non-interacting point contact to reach the quantum limit. Okay, so this S plus minus is essentially a transmission coefficient. For this integrable field theory, the transmission coefficient satisfies the same condition that was needed for a non-interacting quantum point contact to reach the quantum limit. So again, all these kind of surprising connections in how one can look at this model. The net result is, you know, rigorously, you really can reach the quantum limit in this system. Okay, so I'll just, you know, flash these final conclusions. If there's one sort of take-home message at the end of this talk, it's just that how should you think about reaching the quantum limit? Well, you should think about it in terms of there's a constraint on quantum noise. There's a sense in which a system can really have ideal quantum noise. What does it take to have ideal quantum noise? There shouldn't be any wasted information in your system. So I will stop there. Yeah, thanks.